Welcome back to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris. We're going to conclude this series with Walter Sinnott Armstrong's interview. Again, you might want to get the book. Dr. Craig debated Walter Sinnott Armstrong several years ago, and that became a book called God? A debate between a Christian and an atheist. Really good exchange, and it was a couple of debates that were put in book form. It explored the Big Bang, fine-tuning of the universe, the existence of objective moral values, evidence for Jesus, hiddenness of God, lots of topics in that book, and you can get it at reasonablefaith.org. So pick up the paperback at reasonablefaith.org. This series has given us a chance to revisit some of the topics of that debate. When we saw that Robert Kuhn had interviewed Walter Sinnott Armstrong, we wanted to interact with that a little bit and see if we could update some of the topics.
Well, oftentimes they would be joined together, and then the dichotomy would be the law chance on one side and the personal Judeo-Christian God on the other. Right. And that indeed is a false dichotomy, because there are innumerable explanations that are not either one of those.
Yeah, let's pause there. Now, that's unfair by Robert Kuhn. He knows better than this. People who propound the fine-tuning argument aren't arguing for the Judeo-Christian God. They're saying that some sort of intelligence has designed the universe. And similarly, the intelligent design theorists who argue for intelligence behind biological complexity aren't arguing for the Judeo-Christian God, or they would even say for God at all. They're just arguing for the hypothesis of intelligent design.
More of a generic theism.
Not even right? Theism.
Really?
No,
just an intelligence.
No, just intelligence. I mean, it could be that we're in the laboratory of some super human alien intelligence that has formed our universe in their laboratory or something like that. Right. That would be an intelligent design hypothesis. Yeah. And with regard to intelligent design, the claim there, at least by intelligent design theorists, with regard to biological complexity, isn't even theism. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they're being disingenuous about this. I think they're quite sincere. Now, they are theists, obviously. William Dembski, Michael Behe, Steve Meyer, they're theists. But the argument they offer is not an argument for theism, per se. And I think they're quite sincere when they say that. So when Richard Dawkins says in that famous interview that he would prefer to explain the evolution of biological complexity by extraterrestrial intelligent life rather than God, that is an appeal to intelligent design. That is an intelligent design hypothesis.
Yeah. Yes.
A non-theistic one, but that is an appeal to intelligent design.
Yeah.
I'm not saying those other explanations are right or even more probable.
Exactly.
Some of them may be very obscure. But from a logical point of view, you have not exhausted the universe of possibilities at all by setting up that dichotomy.
Exactly. So when someone lays out a dichotomy or a trichotomy, then what you need to ask yourself is, are those really incompatible?
This is a fair point. Mm-hmm. Say you're given a body of data to explain. And then what the theorist does, whether it be a scientist or a historian, whatever, you then assemble a pool of live options, live explanatory options, and you leave out the crazies. And then you assess these live explanatory options in terms of things like their explanatory power, their explanatory scope, and so forth. And it might be possible that you could combine some of these, and that would be an explanatory option. That's fair enough. Or you might look for another explanatory option that wasn't in your original pool. So those points are fine.
The other thing you have to ask yourself is there a fourth possibility that they've left off the list?
Yes, right, because the only way to make that argument an effective one is if you can demonstrate universal exhaustion.
No. See, that's unfair. Again, that would make science impossible, Kevin, if you had to have universal exhaustion of alternatives.
Good luck with that.
well, I mean, it's just simply literally impossible. That's not the way science works. As I said, when the scientist is explaining a body of data, he assembles a pool of live options to explain it. And he leaves out the crazies. For example, that this happened because Jane Eyre, when she was writing Pride and Prejudice, somehow had a trans-temporal causal connection to this that caused a mutation in the animal, and that was beneficial or something. You don't do that. You don't need
that's not a live option. That's a dead option.
Yeah, well, that's right, Kevin. Yeah. And so, as I say, in talking about the fine-tuning of the universe, you read the literature, and you can discern what the live explanatory options are in the literature. And if there is another live option, go ahead and propose it. Of course, that will need to be considered. But don't tell us this nonsense about you have to have universal, exhaustive knowledge of every alternative and eliminate it.
Universal exhaustion, so that you have covered everything, and then you also, to really have a logical argument, you have to have mutual exclusivity.
Right.
So you have to have universal exhaustion so that every possibility conceivable is on your list or embedded within the ones on your list, and that they are exclusive in some way, so it is logically impossible for more than one to be true. If you can do that, then the argument is a valid one.
See, you just destroyed science. You don't deal in logical possibilities. We're dealing here in what's the best explanation.
And did he actually say, if you can do that, exhaust it and everything, the argument is valid?
That's what he said, Kevin.
Does he mean valid and sound?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he would say, if you've been able to prove that it's either A or B or C or D ad infinitum, and that it's not B or C or D or E ad infinitum, then you can validly conclude that it's A.
And by the way, I've exhausted all the options for this argument that I'm making right now.
Oh, that's a good point. I mean, these assertions that he's making,
Have they been exhaustively?
Have they been proven in this way? Why should we believe what he says?
Yeah.
Exactly.
But it is almost impossible to do
it. It is impossible.
Well, I don't know. There's some pretty good arguments of that form, but maybe not in this area.
Right.
Exactly. Another fallacy is equivocation. Very often, a term will be used in different ways in the course of the same argument. And you can make one step when it means one thing, but then you can't make the later step.
Okay, let's talk about that. This is the informal fallacy of equivocation, where you use a term with two different meanings. For example, Greek is a language. Socrates was Greek. Therefore, Socrates is a language. That would be fallacious because you're using the word Greek there with two different meanings, one to talk about a linguistic type, the other to talk about a nationality or ethnicity, and that would be fallacious. That commits the informal fallacy of equivocation.
You notice the title here, Fallacies When Arguing for God?
Yeah.
Well, Bill, it's also for lobsters.
Yeah, that's exactly
anything. Equivocation is a fallacy no matter what.
Yeah, these are not fallacies in arguing for God in any particular sense.
You can make that later step, but then you can't make the earlier step. And so you have to look at multiple meanings of the term. For universe, for example, sometimes means just the physical universe as we experience it and what we live in. Sometimes it includes God. Sometimes it includes what happened before the Big Bang. That term gets thrown around and used in many different ways, and that creates problems in a lot of the arguments that use that concept.
Right. It is important to define your terms clearly because they're often used with different meanings. I find this is especially true, Kevin, in discussions of biological evolution. The word evolution is an accordion word which can be expanded and contracted to mean many different things. Sometimes it simply means common descent from a primordial ancestor. Other times it will refer to reconstructing the tree of life and showing how things emerged from previous life forms. Other times evolution refers to the explanatory mechanisms of random genetic mutation and natural selection. And that's why it's so misleading when somebody says, do you believe in evolution? The question is impossible to answer until you've defined your terms.
Yeah.
So the point he's making is a good one that we all need to keep in mind.
And to his favor, he did, in this point, at least give an example when equivocation, when arguing for God, would be wrong. And so he at least...
You mean with respect to the word, the universe could be used with a different scope. You know,
so he's given an example of equivocating when arguing for God, when really all of these fallacies apply to everything.
Sure.
But at least he's given an example here.
Yeah, he's trying to.
What are some other fallacies? Well, another very common fallacy is the straw man fallacy. You present your opponent's position as a straw man, something can easily be torn up, and then you make fun of your opponent, but it's not really their position, so it's not a fair move. One example of that is when theists say that atheists must believe that nothing's really morally right or wrong, there's no objective morality.
That is not a straw man. That is a position, as he earlier admitted, is affirmed by many atheists, like Nietzsche, Russell, Sartre, and on today's scene, Rosenberg, Marx. There are lots of atheists who do affirm that there are no objective moral truths, no objective moral values and duties. So that's not a straw man. That is a prominent and respected position. Now, it's not one that all atheists hold. In fact, probably most don't. Yeah. But it is a position that merits examination and criticism. So that's not a straw man. A straw man fallacy occurs when you misconstrue your opponent's argument and you attack your caricature of the argument rather than the argument itself.
But who wants to have somebody who doesn't believe that rape is wrong marry their daughter? And so you're going to be able to make fun of atheists and get people to turn against atheists by ascribing to atheists a position that they don't hold.
Let me pause there again. It's not a matter of making fun, as he suggests. You can offer legitimate criticisms of positions like the one that he mentioned. It's not at all a matter of making fun, even in attacking a straw man. It's not that you're making fun of the straw man argument. It's that this is a different argument than the one your opponent offered. Mm. That's what makes it a straw man. You're attacking this false representation of your opponent's argument, but that doesn't mean you're making fun of it. That's not where the fallacy is.
Another example of the same fallacy is with regard to, for example, the resurrection of Jesus. It's reported in the New Testament that three women found the tomb of Jesus empty after the crucifixion, after he'd been buried in the tomb. And theists will sometimes say to atheists, well, what do you think? These three women were lying? I don't want to accuse these three women of lying, so it puts me in a very difficult position.
I would agree with Synod Armstrong that when Christians attack the skeptic's view and saying that on the skeptic's view the disciples were all liars and deceivers, that would be a straw man, because that isn't what the modern skeptic says. But I have to say that in the past, that is exactly what they said. When you look at the history of literature on this, in the late 18th and 19th century, that was the claim, that the disciples were liars and deceivers who made this up. And unfortunately, some Christian apologetics is still fighting the battles of yesteryear and are attacking those alternatives. So it's not so much that they're straw men as that they're obsolete. That isn't what the modern skeptic is saying. He's not saying the disciples were liars and deceivers.
Bill, I have to ask you, doesn't that sound like Senator Armstrong is a little unsophisticated in his critique of the resurrection? Because, he just said, somebody will say to me, these three women found the tomb empty, and were they lying? They weren't lying. Well, is that what he thinks is the state of the art?
I'm a little surprised at that, I must say, Kevin. I mean, I agree that would be to attack a straw man, but nobody that I'm aware of says such a thing. I've not seen this in any literature, whether scholarly or popular, for that matter.
He might have just directed his own straw man.
Yeah. You know, Kevin, that's a good point.
I mean,
maybe he's just illustrated the straw man fallacy.
Because my response is, I don't know exactly what did happen. I just know I don't think he rose into heaven. Maybe they were lying. Maybe they were deluded. Maybe somebody else took it before they showed up. I don't know. But don't saddle me with the position of accusing these women of lying.
Okay, that's not a straw man fallacy. I think he's just simply misidentified it. If you say neither lying nor deluded nor someone else stole the body, that's simply eliminating the live explanatory options. There's nothing straw man about that.
With all of these fallacies, some of them emerging from what we would both consider very smart people, philosophers,
oh, yeah.
Why do you think these occur?
I think the real motivation for religious belief comes from morality. People believe that if you don't believe in God, you can't be a moral person. They want to be a moral person. And it also comes from religious experience. People really do have these religious experiences, and they don't know how to understand them in any way other than through their typical religious and theistic doctrines. So when they really want to believe something, they want to argue for a conclusion, they've already decided what conclusion they want to reach, then these arguments come along. And when people start deciding on the conclusion first and constructing the arguments later, that's when you typically get fallacies.
An argument is sound or not regardless of the person's motivation for propounding that argument. The argument could be offered by a machine and still be sound or unsound. To try to attack an argument because of the motivation of the person offering it is a fallacy. That is the fallacy ad hominem of attacking the person and his motivations rather than the argument itself. And so Senator Armstrong ends his video interview on logical fallacies by committing one and giving us a prime example.